if I don't write it down, it doesn't happen.
Exactly.
Oh, geez. I mean, we could spend the rest of the hour on that. But.
When two people arrive at a conclusion separately, I'm always like, there must be some truth into this. Welcome, everybody. This is Tuesday Morning Grind, episode number 67. And it is rare when you do a podcast that you get to speak to someone who has such a similar background as yourself, which makes the conversation just really easy. And today we're going to talk about all things security, security leadership, what it's like to be a virtual CISO, how to build out programs, how to manage people, a lot of business and security tie-in, which is one of my favorite topics to talk about. So today we have Rock Lambros with us. Rock is the author of the book CISO Evolution. If you guys haven't checked that book out, it's getting a lot of love from the security practitioners in the community. So that's always a great sign. Rock also has his own business. He's the founder of Rock Cyber, where he does virtual CISO and security assessment work, and just a longtime security executive. So Rock, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
Yeah. So how did you build your career in cybersecurity? Can you kind of just give us the background, how you got into security and fell in love with it?
Yeah, so I actually came out of college being an Oracle developer and Oracle DBA. And then this is going to sound totally cliche, but 9/11 hit. And, you know, maybe one of the few things I predicted right in my life was that, hey, like this next battle space is going to be, yeah, we're still going to have the planes and guns, but it's going to be, you know, back in 2001, this relatively new thing called the internet. Mm-hmm. And so I started pivoting my career more towards database and data security, and then had the opportunity to work in some really great environments like eBay and consult for some different organizations, and then run a security operations center for the federal government, and just kind of came up through the ranks that way, definitely through the technical side.
Yep.
And then had the opportunity to build a few smaller security programs, and then finally, before starting consulting, at an oil and gas company here in downtown Denver that was later acquired by Marathon Petroleum. So after about 2 years of that integration work, you know, I was trying to decide, hey, you know, now what do I want to do when I grow up? And I've been wanting to throw my hat into the consulting ring for a while, like hanging my own shingle. Yep. Talked to my wife, and made the leap, and here we are. Now 3.5 years later, and so glad I did it.
That's awesome. So you grew up, it sounds like, more in the technical side, but just from speaking to you and like reading the book, there's a lot of like more business related and leadership related lessons. When did you come to realize, or when did you gain the passion of, you know, security isn't just the technical side of it, it's about communication and being able to articulate business risk and manage people and manage talent. Yeah. Like how did that, was that like a slow arrival or a slow conclusion that you gained over time, or did you have an epiphany moment? How did you get there?
I wouldn't say there was an epiphany moment, but certainly during my tenure at eBay, I decided that, hey, I wanted to go back and get a master's degree.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, I figured I could learn all the technical things in the world on the job or, you know, via Google or whatnot, but I knew that I wanted to progress more into the management and leadership ranks. So I figured a more structured approach to learning, like, you know, all those business acumen topics that we talk about in the book, worked for me. And I'm not saying you need to get an MBA to, you know, be a good security leader or a good CISO, but there are definitely topics throughout most MBA programs that you need to understand to allow you to, like you just said, kind of connect to the business and be a business leader versus just a technical leader, and be able to align your programs accordingly.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, eBay, you know, they're awesome. They supported me through that journey, got my MBA, and then was able to, that, you know, obviously opened up a lot of opportunities for me on the leadership side that I may not have gotten if I didn't have it.
Yep. Yeah, I think that's such an interesting thing about information security. And I always describe it to people, you can kind of tell that the discipline is still in its infancy, because we're still discovering stuff like, hey, you need all these leadership and communication and business skills to be a great security practitioner. Whereas I think a lot of it's still kind of part of the ethos that you need to be very technical. There's kind of two parts to the book for people who haven't read it. The first part of the book, some of the things I like about it are like talking about company valuations and financial models and stuff and how that impacts cybersecurity. And then part two, the part you contributed with is talking about human capital management, business cyber risk. And those are just such important topics when you think about being a leader in cybersecurity. You wrote something, and this is like straight out of my playbook, so I'm kind of laughing about it, is like translating cyber risk into business risk. Because sometimes there's like a bridge too far. People think about, hey, cybersecurity is about risk management, keeping the bad guys out, which it is. But if you can't translate that into, you know, what's the value of the business? Why does the business care? Then sometimes those executives can't appreciate that. So can you talk a little bit about that? Like, what's the artistry in bridging those two topics?
Oh, geez. I mean, we could spend the rest of the hour on that. But so, you know, cybersecurity is just like one line item of a long list of risks that the organization has to deal with, mm-hmm. right? So mm-hmm. it's in the integration into enterprise risk management overall as a whole is key, right? So if you can start having those conversations at an elevated level within your organization and, you know, your business leaders start to understand that, hey, you're not just the department of no, you're not just there to tell the business that they can't do something, that you're truly there to grow the value of the business or help in cost reduction efforts or whatever the case may be. Then that allows you to, you know, we clamor for that seat at the table. Those are the conversations that get you that seat at the table, that get you the invitation to the table, right? Mm-hmm. But to be able to do all of that, you have to understand your organization's business model and your organization's strategy, right? And we start talking about that, I think, literally page 30 of the book, like yep. very early on, about how to do that through, you know, business model canvassing. And understanding stakeholder streams and whatnot. So,
yeah, and being able to go ahead. I was going to expand on that. That's such a key thing to think about because when you think cybersecurity, it's so easy to get caught up in those like granular level tasks you're doing. I'm managing a security operations center. I'm performing an audit or whatever the thing you're doing is. If you zoom out, the business is choosing to invest in things for a reason. They're investing in marketing because they want hopefully to win more deals. They're investing in IT because reasons. Well, they're investing in cybersecurity for reasons. And a lot of it's risk management, but not all of it. But if you think about like an oil and gas company, there's conversations going on at the executive level that are very, very high level. There's macroeconomic conversations. There's currency conversion. Like, am I going to trade in the dollar or the peso or what am I going to trade in? There's people turnover issues because maybe 10% of their staff is turning over every year. So they're thinking about that. And one of those line items among many is cybersecurity.
Right.
And often that is a not very well understood line item outside of maybe the headlines or just some fear. And if you're an executive that can come to the table and say, look, based on our business model, we do this. And based on that unique business model, here are some of the unique risk attached to that for our survivability and for us to thrive and based on what our competitors are doing. And Rock, you mentioned like the business canvas where you like do some competitive analysis, business model analysis. But if you can speak in those terms, which you guys write a lot about in the book, then all of a sudden you get a seat at the table with those executives, because you're having an executive level conversation. You're not talking about X's and O's and zeros and ones. You're talking about the business landscape and how information security fits uniquely into that landscape. And that, to me, that's part of the journey. And I love that you guys touch on that.
And that's why we wrote the book, because we realized that there was a disconnect, right? We were at that time in 2020. And, you know, we were still, you know, every conference you go to, there's entire tracks dedicated to, you know, CISOs becoming business leaders or CISOs connecting with the business or aligning your cybersecurity program to the business or executive leadership. So we identified that, you know, why is there still a problem? Mm-hmm. And, you know, we broke it down into the three parts of the book, which is business acumen, communication and education, and then frankly, leadership, right? And they all tie together. So like you said, foundational business acumen. What's EBIT and EBITDA and why do you care? Is your organization more CapEx focused or OpEx focused? And why do you care as a security leader? So being able to tailor your conversations accordingly is key, right? To get that seat at the table that we keep talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll point out too, because I think you mentioned some of your background with the eBays and the oil and gas. Is that still the market you largely serve as kind of like pretty large companies, or who do you consult for today?
No, I'd say most of my target market is kind of mid enterprise.
Yeah.
Series, either very well funded Series A companies and up, or Series B funded and up. But I've got publicly traded companies, startups. But really that mid-enterprise space, I would say, you know, 50 to maybe 1,000 employees,
yep.
Somewhere like right in there.
Yeah, we're very similar, actually, serve a very similar market space. And one of the things that I think surprise a lot of people is just pretty much there's a use case for security, no matter the stage of the company. So at Risk360, we're about 50 people, and we have ISO certifications. And there's two reasons we did it. We did it, one, because you're a security company and you need to be able to show your homework and, like, you know, eat your own dog food. So that was a right. big driver. But there's also a good business reason. And that was because when we're going through the diligence life cycle with customers, you know, of course, they're going to ask, well, what do you guys do for security? Can I give you my data? So we wanted to be able to, you know, pass the sniff test when it comes to the sales cycle. And I see that with a lot of my high growth tech clients, you know, even at the executive level, maybe they're not... like they know security is a thing, but the reason that they're willing to really put spin towards it is because it's between them and the deal. You know, they want to do business with Bank of America. They can't do that unless they can demonstrate they have a security program. On the opposite end of the spectrum is critical infrastructure. You know, I'm a oil pipeline somewhere, and if a cybersecurity attack hits my IoT devices, well, that's a really big deal for many, many reasons. So if you're listening to this and you're thinking, well, I don't know if my company has like a real need for security, how do I articulate that? There is a reason. There's 100% reason. What are you saying? Like, are there common reasons why companies are choosing to engage you or invest in cybersecurity programs?
Yeah, you kind of nailed it on the head. You know, there's like two like very broad ranges, right? On one side of the equation, it's the reducing sales friction. And what I've seen, frankly, in the market, like for in the past 5 years, an ISO 27001 or a SOC 2
yep.
have gone from being kind of nice to haves to now being barriers of entry into the market, right? Particularly if you're in a high tech growth industry or a SaaS model type of industry or whatever.
Yep.
Now it's just like it's table stakes, right? And yes, you know, there's the hey, we're going to check the boxes. But if you're going to invest the money to attain ISO 27001 or a SOC 2, most companies are choosing to invest in doing it right. And what does that doing it right mean? It means not just checking the boxes, legitimately putting a security program and security controls into place, because they know now they're seeing that they could be held, you know, liable for damages. We're starting to see a lot of that type of stuff being adjudicated. We're starting to see cyber insurance liability premiums skyrocket as a result of companies, well, having continuous breaches, yep. right? So they see the value there, but it's also right-sizing it for the organization. Not everybody's going to require like NSA level type of security. And as security leaders and practitioners and consultants, we need to go in and try and figure out what is that right size from a risk-based perspective. What is the right level of investment in the various areas? What various areas of the framework or your underlying control structure, you know, call it NIST cybersecurity framework. As an organization, do we need to focus more on the identify side or the protect side or yep. protect or detect side, right? That's a... almost a jihad in our industry right now, right? So, you know, being able to understand the context of the organization and that frame is key. And then on the other side of the equation is exactly what you said. Life and safety is at risk, you know, from an operational technology or IoT perspective. you know, critical services to the citizens, whether it be oil and gas pipeline, power grid, water, wastewater, or whatever the case might be. Right, that's becoming more and more table stakes, and the government is still trying to wrap their arms around how do we put in an effective framework or regulate these industries, you know, or whatever the case may be, because, you know, outside of power, there's not really any regulation for. I mean, you could say the pipelines now because of the TSA directive, but even that's pretty light. There's very little oversight for water, and so, you know, we still got a lot of work to do.
Yeah,
on the critical infrastructure side.
Yeah, it's such a weird thing because, I mean, in the news you hear that pretty much everybody's talking about like the risk, especially with the Russia-Ukraine thing going on, the risk of like critical infrastructure undergoing a cyber attack. And if you talk to anybody who's been in the industry, it seems like there's a lot of consensus that if someone wanted to do something pretty bad, they probably could. Like that stuff's not adequately protected. It's not foolproof. So someone could disrupt a power plant or something if they really wanted to. But there's, like you said, not super strong regulation around that or specifics around how you would go about doing that. But here we are in an environment. I did a presentation to my team yesterday where you have like Meta, like there's a metaverse being formed. You have a crypto and all sorts of cool decentralized stuff happening there. You have IoT devices. And, you know, I think I read there's like 13 billion of them out there right now. So even in our most basic infrastructure, there's not regulations around that. But as a technological society, we are like, you know, decades past that. So there's like almost no hope, at least in my mind, not to be cynical, that like the regulators are going to be in sync with like the realities of cybersecurity.
No.
So I always wonder, like, what's self-regulation in an environment like that can look like? I guess it's marketplace dynamics, like SOC 2 reports and stuff like that, like companies doing due diligence on each other. But you mentioned communications. That's something I struggle with. So we'll come into a company, we'll be on a vCISO gig, or I'll be talking to a friend or something in the security space. And probably the most common complaint I get is, I know all the stuff I need to be doing or have a pretty good sense, but I can't either convince executive team to allocate the spend on it, or I can't communicate to them in a way that will resonate. Do you have like some tips or things that you've seen work in terms of like communication, getting leadership on board with stuff, building out business cases that has worked for you?
Kind of, we've had to become storytellers,
yeah,
right? As security leaders to, I don't want to say craft stories because we're not like making up stories, but you know, you've got to be able to understand your audience, being able to relate, you know, whether it be your cybersecurity initiatives, you know, being able to formulate it and kind of like in the form of a story. You know, you can tie like a lot of the stuff that we do in the office to home and personal use, right? Security awareness training and anti-malware and stuff like that. And you could translate it to, you know, stories around home use and protecting the family and stuff like that. That will resonate with executives. Part of it is understanding your audience,
yeah,
right? And, yeah, you know, the data is the data, but the way you present the data and you talk about the data, you know, should be molded and individualized for the audience that you're speaking to. The CFO is going to want to hear a different story than your CEO and a different story than your COO potentially, or head of op, or especially in an oil and gas company, right? The head of operations and engineering, stuff like that. So understanding, you know, the individual's role within the organization, what's going to resonate with them, and then being able to present the data accordingly.
Yep.
And in an engaging fashion, is the key.
How strategic are you, when you enter an organization, to like inventory who you need to talk about and how you need to talk to them? Because you rattled off some stuff that's like based on experience, probably just pretty intuitive. Like, you know, I got to talk to the head of sales this way and the COO this way. It's just based on reps. But if you're kind of coming in and doing an analysis of a, let's say a medium complex organization, are there tools that you use, or how do you wrap your head around like how to approach that?
Yep. So first of all, I always talk to my primary stakeholder, who's inevitably either the CISO, or if I'm the virtual CISO, it's usually either the CTO or either the CEO directly, and try and get essentially an inventory of stakeholders, right? And then do stakeholder value mapping, which we talk about in the book as well, right? So sort of understanding how each stakeholder, what they bring to the business, what their responsibilities are, and what do they need as inputs. So that way they can provide, you know, their outputs to the business.
Yep.
So start there, right? And then it's kind of like you start unpeeling the layers of the onion, or, you know, going down different paths, if you will, because you may run into someone that says, oh, by the way, you need to go talk to someone in India who you're like, didn't even hear about in the original conversations. And it's, you know, I found situations where it's like, wait a second. I've been here a month and you're just telling me about that team that's outsourced in Eastern, you know, in the Ukraine. That would have been good to know ahead of time, right? So you start peeling back the layers of that onion. And then, you know, with everybody, it's like, okay, what, you know, understanding what their primary initiatives are, what are their goals? What are they looking to achieve as part of like what you bring to the table from a security program perspective? Or are you there to erase, you know, the ghosts of CISO's past?
Yep.
Right? Have they had a bad taste or a bad experience with the prior security leader, or even with the current security organization that you have to start to work and navigate around? There are a lot of variables involved. And yeah, some of it's intuition, some of it's experience. But again, it kind of goes back to understanding the organization's business model. And from there, you could start peeling things apart.
I think sometimes, at least for me, it has in the past, earlier in my career especially, I significantly underestimated the amount of work it takes to navigate an organization and understand who you need to talk to. So when you're doing this, and you mentioned stakeholder value map, inventory of stakeholders, is this literally a list, like a document you're creating, or is this a mental model?
Oh, no. If I don't write it down, it doesn't happen.
Exactly. We do the exact same thing in our vCISO practice. One of the very first things we do is a vCISO inventory. And then you're writing down, like, who are they? Who do they report to? What do they care about? What was their prior experiences? And when we have new staff join, new consultants on our team, they're always surprised by that step. And I'm like, no, we got to, like, plan a whole full day working session to go through this. And they're like, man, I just never thought about needing to do that. And a lot of the people who listen to this podcast are internal full-time security professionals. But I think there's an incredible amount of value. Even if you're a GRC manager or something, even if you know kind of intuitively who you need to talk to and stuff, just writing that down, because it's like a strategy session with yourself, even if you're a security team of one, to think about who you need to have conversations with, who you need to influence, who needs to buy on different decisions. And that's just a huge body of work that often is unaccounted for. I told you, I wrote that, I sent it right ahead of this podcast. I wrote that 5-part CISO series. And I was reading your book, and I was like, man, it's like we wrote the same book. So it's just like when two people arrive at a conclusion separately, I'm always like, there must be some truth into this. And that's one of the things that really resonated.
And mind you, like, you know, we're how far into our conversation right now? And we haven't talked about, got to look into the sim and see what's going on, right? And we haven't talked about any of that. Like, part of you know, being a security leader is being able to kind of poke your head up above the clouds, right? And being able to lead the organization as a whole, right? Because, like, going back to that storytelling, you know, the CFO, frankly, does not care how many critical high and medium vulnerabilities you've got floating around the network month over month, right? Your CEO may care, should care about trends. Is it going up or down? Yep. Staying flat? Why, if it's staying flat, is that fine? Is it not fine? Why do I care, right? And we get too just wrapped up into, like, our operational metrics.
That's a hard thing. That's a hard pill to swallow sometimes from a career perspective. And I think CTOs and other technology-oriented careers probably deal with the same thing. But a lot of times, the thing that you love that got you to where you are, like being a great technician, is a completely different, often completely different skill set than what you need to be a great leader. Then you get into these soft skills and business and finances, and it's pretty much the same stuff that any executive is dealing with. But that can come as a surprise often, because if you look at any CISO job description on LinkedIn or something, it's really highlighting the frameworks you need, the expertise you need. But rarely does it say, well, you need to be a master in communication and putting together a budget and understanding business models. But those are all prerequisites to be an executive.
Yeah.
You wrote a lot about just managing people, like recruiting is a big piece of it, managing human capital. And we are in an industry that is virtually zero unemployment, maybe even negative unemployment. There's probably more jobs than there are people trying to get jobs, especially at certain seniority levels. Let's start with recruiting and leading people. Like, what are your thoughts there? How do organizations get top tier and keep top tier security professionals?
Yeah, from a recruiting perspective, like, leverage your network first, right? I talk about in a book how to apply a couple different models, but primarily we reference a model called top grading, which can be kind of cumbersome if you follow it to the T, like the GEs of the world have used, but you can adapt it to fit your organization. But, you know, for me, my success has always been leveraging my network first. Hey, you know, do you know someone who's looking? Are they, you know, what we call an A player? Are they a B player? Or even someone, frankly, like you said, there's like probably negative employment in our industry right now. It's crappy, but everybody's poaching from each other, right? So it's like, hey, do you know someone who's ready for a change, not jiving with their current role or situation? Right now, we've got incredible labor movement because of the whole work from home, work remote thing that has come up over the past couple of years. You know, so maybe they're forced being going back into the office and they really want the flexibility of working from home, whatever the case may be, even though their resumes are probably not out there on LinkedIn and Indeed for you to pull from, being able to kind of network your way into those individuals, I think is key, right? And the part of that is building your own network and then fostering your own network. And that includes, you know, pinging your own employees. Hey, who do you know? Who do you trust to bring in to do this job? Yep. You know, yeah, it's great that they're a friend, but do you trust them that they're going to take, you know, workload off of your plate and do it as strongly as you would do it, right? Or as effectively as you would do it versus like, hey, you know, I'm going to bring in a friend and we're going to slack off all day. And then you end up with all the work because the friend is incapable, right?
Yep.
So just that's kind of the talent pool I look towards. And then also start thinking outside the box. You know, I beat the drum, like GRC roles, a lot of GRC roles, like accountants would be great for. You know, a lot of security awareness roles, or, you know, if they're building out a security awareness program, a lot of like marketers and educators would be great, you know, a great fit for. You have a e-discovery function within your organization, you're large enough to be able to do your own forensics. You know, former cops would probably be really good in that role. Or former Leo would be really good at a security analyst type of role where they just got to sift through data and look for patterns and do the investigative things required to be successful in that role. So I think we're also, you know, not looking at all, you know, all the places that we could be looking to.
Yeah, I agree. We hire probably about 30 professionals per year in security roles, like internally, because we do consulting. So we have a higher than most internal security orgs would. But so we've had to shift from family and friends kind of network. We exhausted that, although we always ask, especially our new folks, to hiring some of our entry level roles from non-traditional sources, just like you said. Like, one role that we found to be really good is product owners, product managers, and customer success, because they kind of get the tech stack, they're tech savvy, they're good communicators, they understand the business problem. So if you can overlay that with some technical acumen, you know, they're pretty successful.
Right.
In the same roles you talked about, like just non-traditional folks trying to close that talent gap, which is just crazy right now. We have our head of talent and culture. One of her duties is recruiting, which I think is more and more taking up her time. But she's just constantly recruiting. But it's funny because, you know, I never imagined when I started this business, like I always knew that getting new customers would be a key part of doing a business. But what you don't see coming is, well, that becomes the easy part. And the hard parts now is like getting the talent, trying to recruit. So we're kind of in a multi-faced battle of acquiring clients, but also acquiring talent, which is turning out to be really the harder part. And we're competing against every other company out there that's trying to get top tier security
talent. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, for me, I've had pretty good success just leveraging subcontractors. So people who are looking for effectively side gigs, right? Side hustles.
Yep.
And I've been lucky, or maybe it's just it's more of a pattern that I wasn't expecting to see, is that they're just as dedicated in this quote unquote side hustle that as, you know, me hiring a full-time employee, or I would expect of a full-time employee. How they're managing that time, God, I wish I knew. but they're being effective. And, you know, that provides me with some flexibility to scale up and down, but also provides them with some flexibility. It's, well, where I think it's a sign of the times. Like we are migrating more and more to a gig economy.
Yep.
And we've been seeing that over the past decade. And I think we're starting to see that a little bit in cybersecurity. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal probably about 6 months ago now or so, where it was talking about people actually taking on multiple full-time gigs, working remotely, but they are able to balance 3 or 4 full-time gigs. And literally, I don't recommend this, but this is just a sign of like where things are going. You know, they may be on 2-3 conference calls at the same time, or, you know, listening in on one, actively participating in the other, and being able to balance these roles and making, you know, 7 figures a year. And I'm like, God, first of all, I don't want that level of stress. But B, there are absolutely those individuals out there that will do that.
Yep. And then we can talk about the cybersecurity risk of someone having 2 jobs the same endpoint, because it's a BYOD device.
Yeah.
But absolutely right. Like this whole gig economy has changed everything. And then you add on, even before the pandemic, they were talking about the gig economy. Then you hit pandemic when everyone's also working from home. And then you add on 15% inflation where people feel they need an extra side gig. There's all sorts of opportunities. Do you think there's things that companies can do to like stand out or be uniquely attractive to security professionals? Like it's not the same old gig everyone else is offering. Is there any like special things people can do?
I don't know about special, but I mean, you've got to treat individuals as humans, right? Like as humans, we have lives. We have lives outside of the office. We have kids to take care of, parents to take care of, doctor's appointments to run to, school functions to run to. So as long as you can treat people as adults and understand that, hey, the work will get done. As long as, first of all, you have to build that level of trust with your team, right? Like, hey, the work's got to be done by Friday. I don't care how and when you get it done. It's got to get done by Friday. So, and let them manage, you know, the 24 hours in their day accordingly. I think people are valuing that type of flexibility more and more, even so than necessarily the dollar amount on their paycheck.
Yeah.
Now, given the inflationary period that we're in right now, we may start seeing a shift the other way. But, you know, I think people are starting to value that flexibility and of their time and independence more than, you know, maybe I could shave off a couple grand a year on a paycheck for another opportunity that would have had me tethered to a desk and, you know, asking my manager every time I could take 3 hours off for a doctor's appointment, right?
Like, yep. I told Jess on our team, I was like, it's not even an or thing. Like, can I do this or this? It's like an and thing. Like, there's really nothing. We have to do everything. You have to pay really well. You have to offer great benefits. From a work perspective, we're hybrid. So if you're in Atlanta, you can come into the office. We have a nice office, or you can work from home sometimes. But it's like, it's such a employee marketplace where they can demand the terms that you just got to do everything. You got to treat people well. You got to offer them great benefits, which as an employer, it makes it difficult. It's very challenging. But you also know in the back of your head, well, that's probably what everyone should have been doing the whole time. So it's like kind of a nice corrective force to make folks do that.
Yep. Yeah, I like, you know, I like the idea of, and I'm experimenting with this now, of unlimited PTO, but then potentially like forcing people to take PTO, right?
Mm-hmm.
The whole, I guess you could say, joke with unlimited PTO is, oh, everybody's so busy, they're never going to take the PTO anyways. It's like, no, you've got to force people to disconnect and take some downtime and, you know, go be with their families or go disconnect and become a hermit, whatever the case may be. Just get them to focus on something other than work.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because burnout is a thing, right?
We do the same thing. So we do unlimited PTO. But some people are just bad. Me being one of them, like you just never take time off. So we don't mandate it. Like people can still not do it, but we highly encourage it. We go one step almost to mandating time off. And then we do every 5 years, we do a sabbatical program. So you get a month off, and that is mandatory. You have to take a month off to go enjoy family. I just did mine back in July, went up to Montana. And the other thing we do is summer hours. So between, what is it, Memorial Day and Labor Day, maybe I have those reversed, but we do half day Fridays. But it's all that stuff. And the people I immediately coach, I tell them to build in clarity breaks throughout their week, which means like take a half day and just think, like let your subconscious ruminate and ideas come forth. Because if you're just always doing busy work, you don't have that kind of time to think. But those are things that we've really had to do over the last 6 years to get people to feel like this is a great place to work. And I think you go back even. I mean, when I first started, we didn't need to do all that stuff. It didn't feel like 6 years ago. And now 6 years later, like we're constantly trying to innovate and offer new benefits or get people to have better lives. And I'm proud and happy that we are doing those things. But what a crazy employment environment it is where you have to start thinking about employee well-being that much. Maybe that's not new. It's new to me, but it's just kind of pretty cool environment.
Well, like you said, I think it's probably the stuff that we should have been doing all along, right? And I think if anything, what 2020 did is kind of unlock that, saying like, hey, people now are able to find opportunities elsewhere, right? People are now able to find opportunities to be able to work remote. Now, it's going to be very interesting, right, to see how the whole labor market kind of settles out, because you're having people move from very high cost of living areas like Northern California or New York to like Wyoming.
Yep.
Right. But still maintaining their California or New York salaries. And at some point, that's got to all normalize. Right. So we'll see. It'll be interesting to see over the next few years how that all normalizes. Will the geographic disparity in pay shrink as a result? Right? Do you start to offer just one flat salary and wherever you live, that's on you? I don't know.
Yeah, right? I agree.
I don't know what that's going to end up looking like.
We've been impacted by that pretty big because we're out of Atlanta, and Atlanta is a fairly low-cost city compared to the number of jobs here. But more and more, all of our candidates are, we're not just competing with Atlanta anymore. We're competing with Silicon Valley and New York and everything else. So I think we're seeing a little bit of wage inflation. But on the other side of that, there's a lot of people moving from elsewhere in the country to the Atlanta area. So you're seeing housing prices increase. So I think you're exactly right. It's kind of that supply and demand curve just normalizing a little bit, irrespective of geography. Now, we have all that. There's this big environment. And we're dealing with ourselves. With all of this flexibility, people having side hustles, being an employee's marketplace where they can demand the terms, how do you lead a high-performing team and hold them accountable? Like as a manager, how do you still get everything you need out of them given all of that flexibility and freedom? Are there techniques you've seen there?
Yeah, I mean, you know, you've still got, just because they have flexibility does not mean that they don't have performance metrics that they have to hit, right? Does not mean that you like give up on your you know, performance management process. Hell, even like tie this back to security SOC 2, like mandates, right? That there's a performance management process.
Yeah.
They ask for that as evidence. So, you know, being able to tie, I think, you know, the employees, you know, personal and professional development objectives to your organizational objectives, and, you know, being able to show them a path of how directly connect the dots of what they're doing in our world benefits both their client and why, like, this isn't just another engagement, but why it benefits the client, but then why it benefits the organization as a whole, right? And if you could pull them along that story, and I don't mean story as like a fabrication, I mean, you know,
just let them know.
Story, yeah, right. You know, I think you've got engaged employees, right? You've got people who are gung-ho, they want to help. Before you know it, they're asking for, in my experience, asking for other ways that they can help, right? Are there any, you know, off, you know, on the bench type of activities that they can help with while they're, you know, actively out working with a client? You know, I see that they start getting engaged, and, you know, the success of the company, they're committed to the success of the organization, not just from a financial perspective, but from a growth perspective.
Yep. Have you seen, again, this is like one of these new challenges with the modern workforce where people, because they're not physically there and they're always remote and they're not even necessarily physically with their team, they don't necessarily feel as tied or bought into the organization's mission. You know, like maybe they don't care as much about the success of the organization. So tying their own performance to the success of that organization just isn't as high of a, it's not going to drive behavior maybe like it used to. And that kind of comes back to your communication and explaining the why behind things. But have you seen with the teams that you're managing, and I'm sure as a consultant too, you have to influence a lot more than you have authority over. Are there things that you're doing to like help people get excited about, you know, helping the business?
Yeah. So I try and tie the story to, that's a great question, because I try and tie the story to, hey, do you feel like we talk about some of these symptoms in the book. Do you feel like you're burned out? Do you feel like that you're constantly underfunded? Do you feel like you're constantly getting the runaround by the business? Well, let's figure out the why behind that. And then let's go fix it, right? And by fixing it, then all of a sudden, oh, your programs and initiatives are getting funded. Oh, when you reach out to, you know, the head of marketing to talk about how they're managing GDPR requirements on a new outbound marketing initiative, they'll take the phone call, right?
Yeah.
So, and it comes back to understanding the business model, understanding your stakeholders, you know, tie it back to what we were talking about at the top of the conversation.
Yeah. One of the things we do is we initiated a weekly lunch and learn, just because we have a fairly hybrid in terms of number of people that aren't in Atlanta, number of people who are. And if you offer free food, if you're around Atlanta, typically that's the people choose to come in. So we did this lunch and learn thing where every Thursday, so anybody can present and we just fill up the schedule 52 weeks a year. And pretty much I've made it my mission every time that it's my turn to speak, or if I can, I just talk about like the why. Why are we doing things? Why? So it'll be like, how does what you do support Risk360's revenue? Or why do you have a job? Like, what's going on macroeconomically that security suddenly matters? Right. I recently did one when I touched a little bit on what's going on in Ukraine and Russia and the nature of cyber conflict and how that's impacting the world. I say all that to say, you see all these headlines where people want this mission and this purpose. Especially the modern workforce, like they want to be tied to something they feel that matters.
Yes.
And if you can't tie a security operations center's looking at logs all day and flagging incidents, or the GRC personnel who has to go do SOC 2 and ISO and FedRAMP and everything else back to some greater purpose or mission, either it's supporting the business or it's defending against the bad guys or it's part of some greater trend, it's really demotivating. But I know whenever I give those lunch and learns, I can just kind of like do a little sanity check afterwards and get a pulse of how everyone's feeling. And for a good couple of days, people are more energized because they're just like, okay, yes, I'm like, it's crazy what's going on there. We did one about metaverse and cybercrime and everything. And everybody was like, man, that's crazy. Like, this really is the future. This is like what's happening right now. And something about tying everything you do back to the why, whether it be a business objective or a larger objective, is just really energizing, I think, for people. So I always give that tip. If you can, tie it back to the why. And you said those words too.
Yeah, you're dead on. It is a generational thing, right? You know, you look like you're younger than me. I'm a Gen Xer. I think Gen Xers and quote unquote boomers, baby boomers, you know, they're just used to kind of a more, tell me what to do and I'll do it, right? I'll put my head down and do it.
Yep.
But you're absolutely right. Like the millennials, and then I see it in my niece's generation, Gen Z, like they really do want to understand the why. Like, why am I doing this? Why should I bother? You know, the teenage angst of why should I bother? But why am I doing this? How's this helping the mission? What, you know, how am I contributing to the team? Why is what I'm doing matters? And that is the key, like you said, at connecting it to the why.
Yep. I'm a millennial, so I naturally appreciated that. But seeing it getting pointed out is interesting. But we're hiring a lot of you know, people who are 20 years old, or I guess that's Z at this point. Yes. And one of the phenomena that I'm witnessing and I've seen written about is that just job hopping. It seems like a long time ago, people would stay somewhere 10 or 20 years. Whereas now, and I can say this for myself too, like, you know, 2 years, 3 years is considered not a bad tenure. Like, they put in 3 years, that's pretty good. And as a consulting firm where our folks, basically, they put in 2 years here, they can go anywhere they want. They have all the context to do that. So how do you get people to stay? And one of the ways you do that is you give them a mission. And then if they feel like they want to be part of that mission and that journey, they hang around for it. But then the downside of jumping around all the time is sometimes, like, to really get good at something and become a craftsman and to develop a passion, like maybe you're interested in cybersecurity, but for it to become a true passion, you kind of got to hang out there for a while. You got to put in 10 years to really understand the whole breadth of it and the business case behind it and all the things you need to know around communication and just get the reps. So I'll be interested to see like how the job hopping generation develops the expertise you need to love something. At least that was my experience. I didn't love anything until like I got deep into it. And I was like, man, I really like the cybersecurity stuff. I know enough about it to understand the nuance.
Right. I think you're dead on. Like the thing I love most about my job now is the diversity of work that I see across clients and the types of different projects and the cultures I'm involved in. And even just the personalities involved across different mm-hmm. clients, right? That's the stuff I absolutely love the most. Would I be effective at navigating all of that now if I didn't have the 20 plus years of experience under my belt in industry? Absolutely not, right? Like that provided, for me, that provided that foundation to be able to kind of roll with the punches, as you say, because you are dealing with a lot of different personalities, a lot of different cultures across different organizations. Yeah, and it is going to be interesting to see now, like where you do have the gig economy and the job hoppers coming up. You know, how do they, when your experience is as fragmented as that, how do they kind of collectively combine their experience to be able to be, you know, quote unquote expert yeah. down the road, right? You talk about the 10,000,
yeah.
whatever.
Malcolm Gladwell thing, yeah.
Or whatever, right? That you need to become an expert.
I'm sure you probably experienced this, having written a book, but for me, so much of the insight that I'm able to glean from anything, the rare instances I'm able to do that, comes from like reflection and allowing everything that's kind of simmering beneath my subconscious to bring it forth into consciousness, and then maybe even into written form, like you did with the book. To tie it all together, to build a framework, and to like you put together a very logical book that takes you from one place to another and talks about categories of information you need. But you can't underestimate the like number of reps and the amount of thinking you need to be able to make something so complicated seem simple. And that's one of the things I like about your book. And I like about anybody who's an expert is you can make something really complicated seem simple, but that's a difficult thing to do.
Yeah, when you're as old as I am, I joke that, you know, I started out in the industry, I had hair down on my shoulders, you know, grays, and look at what it's done. You do get those reps, yeah. Right? And then it's also, you know, well, like you said, there's a lot of mental power about internalizing, like, all right, I just did a thing. How does this compare or contrast to the other things that I've done? How can I add it to my toolbox? What did I learn from it? What went well? What didn't do well? And be able to, first of all, have that sort of like internalization for yourself, but also then be able to accept criticism or feedback. Doesn't always come as constructive feedback. Sometimes it just comes as criticism. So newsflash, you also need to have a thick skin in this industry. To be able to learn from your experiences and move on, good or bad.
Yep, for sure. Well, Rock, thanks so much, man. I know we're at time here. If you guys want to learn a little bit more about Rock or read his work, you can visit rockcyber.com. That's the consulting piece of the business. Also, check out CISO Evolution. I believe you can pick that up on Amazon, or you can check out the website, Google CISO Evolution. I highly recommend it. It was a great book. Rock, thanks so much for being here. I appreciate it, man.
Christian, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Hey, thank you for watching Tuesday Morning Grind podcast. If you like content just like this from cybersecurity executives, thought leaders, hackers, then come on over to risk360.com. Check out our resource center where we have blog posts, white papers, videos, all for free that can teach you about cybersecurity. If you want to know more about cybersecurity certifications like ISO 27001, SOC 2, PCI, HITRUST, and others, we have a ton of content on that. So whatever you're looking for, we have a lot of resources. Head on over to risk360.com, shoot us a note, and we look forward to keeping the conversation going.